Yeah, it's a decision.
And that would be a possibility.
Yes, yes.
Take a look at that again.
Yeah, I guess the little difference between.
Wait, the public is watching.
There you are.
I can reset, it might be what I was over here. Just reminding people of two things. One is a quantum gravity talk this afternoon, a pedagogic one by Abhay Ashtekar. And a few of us have been sort of listening to some of these, and they're actually, you know, we'll get some, we'll learn from them, and I'd recommend them.
The New York Times science page today has a feature on Ashtekar.
And Roger Penrose is just outside there, and as is Abhay Ashtekar. Okay, yes. So I really, you know, urge people to go for that. And then the second thing is, just to prevent anybody from getting any work done today, Omar Blaise is giving a black hole popular talk. That Omar is very good at doing this sort of thing, and it'd be nice if we went along and support him too, I think, as well. So I sort of, at 4 o'clock in, you know where?
The next sort of is advertising Corwin, which is in the
news.
The popular talk is also here.
Also, yes.
And the popular one is here?
No.
Oh, it's also there. Also there. Okay.
Okay, good. Please go.
Great.
Yes.
So, Jean-Pierre was telling me that this is kind of an open-ended, but I take the philosophy of the editor of the Astrophysical Journal Letters. If it doesn't fit on 4 pages, it's not worth publishing, and if it doesn't fit in an hour, it's probably not worth saying. So I'll try to really make it shorter, but the tool has various purposes, but part of it, as you see, I will be talking
about. Really
there'll be two. I'm trying among what the things that I'll be saying is kind of some things that we believed in, maybe exactly the opposite. So I thought maybe if we split it this way, then those who believe in one side could look only in one side. Well, you'll get the gist pretty quickly. Yes, the rightist and the leftist. So I'll be talking about mega maser disks in AGN. So just by happy coincidence, the actual physical paper that describes some of this work actually came out just this last week. So it's new work, but of course it's about a year old, and some other things have been done since. But the paper was in the paper. So what I'm going to talk about, you probably have all know about mega maser disks, but I don't think there was a formal talk here yet. Yeah. So I'll give a little bit of an introduction on what is the mega maser mission in AGN. And what I'll focus on is some model independent inferences that from which one can infer that at least in some sources all of them, in fact, that we know the emission region is inhomogeneous. Now, of course, that's not a great surprise, but I will try to pursue that point of view to some extremes and specifically focus on models of clumped maser disks, and you will see why. And I'll start by motivating it with the so-called AGN paradigm, which at least the old paradigm, that paradigm has also been evolving. Notice that some of what we are learning from the maser disk may have interesting or important implications to what we think about the AGN paradigm. So really the motivation is to raise questions and to get feedback here, because many of the questions I don't have answers for. Okay, so what is that AGN paradigm? And you can just fill in your blanks or just consider it from the start as obsolete. Having a massive black hole at the center is probably not obsolete. We talked about ranges of 10 to the 6, 10 to the 9, and possibly rotating. And a circumnuclear accretion disk. That, of course, is controversial, whether it's really a disk and what its nature is. But traditionally, there have been two types of general models. One was that material that falls into the center has angular momentum, has to dispose of its angular momentum, and through some viscous accretion disk model. So the classical Shakura-Sanyaev model, and some and thick disk models that have come through the years, and most recently resurrected in this under this ADAF acronym. The other option is that the angular momentum, instead of being moved radially out, is moved up and down, vertically from the disk through some ordered magnetic open magnetic field lines that thread the disk. And the angular momentum, so one has pretty strong magnetic fields still dominated by the inertia in the disk, which twists the fields around. But basically, you can think of the angular momentum moving out by magnetic torques, kind of like Alfvén waves. So if the wave, if the field lines are sufficiently open, they can give rise to winds, supra-Alfvénic centrifugally driven winds. So the other, of course, the AGNs is seen through emission and outflow signatures. The emission is powered presumably by the rotational gravitational energy liberated in the disk and the central and possibly tapping into the central black hole. And these are the kind of ranges of luminosities. And we have the line radiation from the so-called broad emission line region. That would be a main topic here of, that would be relevant. Traditionally, people talked in terms of clouds. That's still, people still use that broad line, broad emission line clouds, narrow emission line clouds, and of course the jets, which may well be hydromagnetically driven, possibly also with radiation pressure effect. So an interesting development based on this paradigm, this is kind of a bare-bone skeleton, and to match all the zoo of active galactic nuclei, certain unification schemes have been proposed. And so really most of the stuff that I'll be talking about, each the practitioners are in the audience, so I'm just to refresh you, when you're young and optimistic, Roger, you wrote this paper. And well, it's amazing how all of this is already in this one cartoon. Lacertes has been superseded, but still is recognizable. But the two kind of directional unification ideas, one is that you have relativistic beaming along the jet, which is what perhaps distinguishes BLRX from faint radio galaxies and beamed quasars from non-beamed quasars when you look right next to the axis. But the other option that was already recognized in this paper, that you may have just geometrical obscuration, and that came to be known as a torus. And this, the nature of this torus, and this torus has figured out a lot in, as you know, in Seifert unification schemes. And the nature of this torus has been a question, a puzzle. Some of the early suggestions, again by two protagonists in the audience. Mitch, do you remember? Do you recognize this? This looks like the.
This version that has a three-dimensional shaded cloud that I remember Roger made fun of.
Yes. You cannot tell a line crawling through it.
So I guess these are the bands for this Big Mac, if that's. So that has basically molecular clouds uplifted near the disk, near the central object. Okay, I didn't say that. And this is the other idea, is that you have warp disks. That Stella Finney brought that in 89, but he was talking then on galactic kiloparsec scales, which was interesting, but of course was also difficult to understand a lot of things that happen on scales of less than a parsec with a warp that happens on kiloparsecs. But certainly the idea was picked up, and more recently, and I'll talk about it since it certainly came up, has come up in the context of the Mesodisc, but here is not very good reproduction of a more recent realization of the radiation torque induced instability, warping instability. And Jim Pringle has done nonlinear simulations of it. So you see some amazing structures developing in the nonlinear regime. This is this disk bending over and over on itself, and this pencil here, not seen very well, is kind of how the ray of light can come out. And if you believe that ionization cones seen in CFETs are really photoionization cones, or also maybe in distant radio galaxies, are just openings for the central radiation to come out and photoionize surrounding gas, then here is the realization through those models. As you will see from, at least from the Mesodisc that we now see, they may be warped, but they ain't crazy. I mean, they don't depend on themselves in this kind of incredible fashion. They are mild warps at best. The other option, of course, for those tori is that it's much less material basically involved, and that's a picture that that John Karchi and I have discussed in a few years ago. Basically, that what you have is the same scientifically driven wind. The scientifically driven wind is an efficient mechanism to rapidly accelerate material just near the disk surface. This rapid acceleration translates into quick, rapid vertical density drops. So such winds are very highly stratified. And as it turns out, if you look, and you can quantify it both for UV obscuration, for X-ray absorption, so here is an accretion disk schematically, and here is the thin lines in poloidal projections coming up, and the flow comes along these thin lines, and it's very highly stratified. If you look from this direction, you can see up to about Thompson optical depth of one, typical parameters, and it rapidly decreases with angle, so that really mimics a torus quite well. And especially since the outer parts beyond the sublimation radius, where a dust particle that is lifted can survive the radiation field, there's the added dust obscuration. But the inner parts, which are can be calculated and have been calculated with a just photoionization code, are partially ionized and, of course, also give rise to X-ray absorption. So that's kind of like a warm absorbing medium. And the newer addition to this model is to make it into a two-phase model by adding clouds to it, clouds that are just uplifted by run pressure and then possibly pushed by the radiation pressure, and then in turn affecting the wind. You'll see some of this cloud picture I'll also mention today in the context of masers, but they have been applied usually broad emission line clouds, broad absorption line clouds, also BLAC type UV absorbing clouds. So this is something I can talk about in a separate discussion, but I'm just bringing it up here. Okay, so what about the masers now? Actually, before the masers, let me draw another nice cartoon. Just nice, I sense that I didn't draw it, but it's nice because it's more quote-unquote sophisticated. See the nice torus there. And this is the case of 1068, which is really the classical archetypal CFET 2 galaxy, and from which Antonucci and Miller deduced this unification idea by looking at scattered light and seeing the broad emission line clouds, broad emission line lines in the polarized emission. So the idea is that in this case we are looking at large angle. There's a very large X-ray absorbing column called hydrogen column of 10 to the 25 per centimeter squared deduced for this source. There are those projected ionization cones. There's evidence for jets coming out interacting with clouds on scales of a few tens of parsecs, the narrow line region, and shocking and being diverted. And 1060, and as I will show you, there is direct evidence that this model works because there's a clear delineation between this direction and the vertical direction. The jet, in fact, is almost perpendicular, so I'll show you to the molecular line distribution that's traced to very close to the central source. So bear this in mind, because this is where the questions would come, because this is one of the main one of the few sources for which we have now imaged mega maser disk, and things would become wouldn't quite fit this picture. So the disk, the masers there. So they're about the mega masers are called by that name because if you take the flux that you measure for them, both in OH and water masers, but most of the work so far was done on water masers. I'll focus on water masers, the 22 gigahertz transition. There are about 20 such sources known, and if you take the flux and imagine that it's radiated isotropically, you get like 20 over 20 solar luminosities, and these are much larger than what you infer for galactic sources in their typical quiescent state, and so you say they are mega masers. As I will argue, basically, I will show in a few minutes that this can be understood essentially exactly the same as galactic masers, and they may be just the same type, with the same mechanisms and same objects, the same type of emission. So, but at least that's how they have been designated. Now, interestingly, they are preferentially associated with Cepheid 2 or Linear galaxies, also that are seen at large angle to with large obscuration. There's a correlation with X-ray absorbing columns. They are preferentially systems that are seen at large angles, that are seen through large obscuration and where you don't see directly the broad emission line region. So that's an important point to bear in mind. I'm not aware of any counterexample to that.
So can we jump to the conclusion that the beams mainly come out of the equatorial plane?
Yes. So the reason why it has become so, just in the last few years, why there's been all this push in there, that two things have converged. There are the spectral observations, so you get the spectra, the velocities, projected radio velocities of the masers, but in very recently, VLBI imaging has actually allowed people to identify the spots, and very close on scales of like 0.1 parsecs nearby Cepheid galaxies. So, as I'll show you some diagrams, they appear to be, and this is again one of the discovery papers, so it's a little bit kind of has been updated since. But what one finds are basically that the masers are distributed in an apparent disk, very thin, rotating, slightly warped circumnuclear disks. And so here is a 4258 is the main source that has been studied, the archetypal source, which probably means that it would be, as I'll also argue, it's probably the source that...
There's only really two or three cases where people say there's strong evidence that it is that you're looking at a disk.
By now there's at least 5, 6, or 7. Well, that have actually been imaged.
Really?
Yeah, that have the high and low velocities.
In the last year, because Jim Moran, I think, wrote some review articles like that.
That was in 95.
About a year ago, and said that there were only, that most of the cases, it was the velocity fields or the structural organization did not look easily interpretable as a disk.
Well, I'm aware of most of the sources that are being studied have already been known for the last few years, because they are just the bright sources and not many new ones are found.
I'm aware of any detailed imaging. Yeah, but 4258 is nice and thin, and it has well-defined.
And then there's 1068. And then there's 1068.
Very recently, the Cygnus galaxy has been imaged. There's NGC 3079.
When I talk to Grinstein and Greenhill and Moran, I always say,
we'd love to see more of these images, and the answer is it's extremely difficult to do this, and it takes an immense amount of observing time to do this.
That's right. I mean, I'm none, except for 4258, none of them looks clean, and even this, as I'll show, when you go to higher order cases, it's not completely clean. But there's evidence that there's high velocity masers on two sides of the central, in at least 10 or so, or almost 10. Well,
yeah, I mean, high velocity on either side.
On either side?
Right, but nice, clean disks.
No, that's right. No, there isn't. There's for this, for the actual velocity profiles, there's maybe just two or three.
Yeah, but, Aria,
do you have copies of any of these new images?
It'd be great to see them, because I don't think
I have some. Well, I didn't. I have a couple here, and no, I don't have any. The most recent one has been just a print on the Cygnus galaxy and 30. But all of these, except for the very last two, are just published. I don't have them here. Yeah, I'll show you what I have, but they okay. Probably wouldn't satisfy. The thing is that I'll show you what I have. I basically am focusing on this too, so except, and maybe I'll show you a third one, but I don't have more. So for this one, this is probably a little bit exaggerated. I think they're really a little bit narrow here. But what you see is the systemic masers, which are roughly the velocity of the systemic velocity of the galaxy, and the high velocity masers along this projected diameter, which is the midline, so-called midline. There are variations in the different sources. In this case, you see the systemic masers are the strongest, and the high-velocity masers are on one side very weak, and on the other side still weaker than the systemic. There are some cases where the systemic are pronounced, and you don't. The high-velocity are pronounced, and you don't even see the systemic. It's also been the case that in most cases so far, but by no means all, the redshifted features are more prominent, both in number and in magnitude of the flux, and that's certainly the case here. And that has been addressed by some models. As you can see, when you look at the high-velocity masers in terms of their projected radial velocities, this is extremely well modeled by Kepler and this, but not really completely. There are deviations from Keplerian motion that I'll mention that have been most recently modeled. And the masses that one infers is like 3.5 by 10 to the 7 solar masses, that they're about for the original distance that one had for the source, which was like 6.4 megaparsecs. But more, one can combine the actual measurements of proper motion of the systemic measure of the systemic masers with the measurement of their centripetal acceleration, which are also measurable on scales of a year or so, a couple of years, and to deduce independently the distance of the source. So people have bootstrapped. They've now increased the distance to 7.2, 7.3 megaparsecs, and correspondingly the mass has changed.
Sorry, that's assuming a Keplerian flow and then fitting out the distance.
This is now just for the systemic masers.
Yes.
Yeah, so assuming that they're on a given radius, yeah. But this can also be a constraint, right?
I think by the deviation between the Keplerian flow consistent with
what?
Are the deviations from the Keplerian velocity?
Well, in this particular source, there one can actually model the deviations in a more systematic way. And one in particular that I'll mention is, I'll mention that there's a recent paper preprint by Herrenstein et al. That I will show some results from that uses that. In the case of 1068, there is no clear Keplerian velocity. There's too few data, and there people say, oh, it's a turbulent motion. I should also mention that there is high variability in these, both in the systemic masers, for example, there's been a, and in the high velocity, the so-called satellite features. And for example, there's been a, just to give you a scale, there's been an adverse, like a factor of 3 change in the flux over a period of 8 months in 40 to 58. And there have been several catalog cases of a flare, in fact, a repetitive type of thing that has been observed repeatedly in a given velocity range. The flare. Say it again.
Is it only in masers, or is it only in, or also in X-rays?
Those observations are only for the masers, so I'm not aware of that they have the information for MOS. So in this case, just to connect it to the paradigm picture, there's evidence for nuclear jet. There's some evidence for what, for a large-scale structure which had been interpreted as a jet, but could be really a bar, according to other interpretation. But certainly on the nuclear, right next to the source, there is a radio jet which played a role in constraining the disk models. And as you see, the shape of those measures has been modeled by mild, nice warp. And I wasn't aware of that, but surprisingly, I think this particular model, the initial model, they really just model the variation of the tilt in this plane. They assume that the inclination angle doesn't change with radius. And only recently, so it's a very, it was a restricted model, and only more recently they added the change of inclination angle with radius. So in this picture you see there's either both tilt and inclination. Here they assume that the inclination doesn't change with radius, just this Euler angle changes in the projected plane.
So how does the line of note vary with radius?
So here it just varies as you...
How does it observe to vary?
Well, there's really no observation. That's all you see.
Oh. I think the models are not really...
The models can't define that.
That
would be rather prescriptive on the origin of the...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the big question is, for example, how many degrees the model approaches.
Yeah. So they've added now... There's a... What they've now used, which I'll say, is the deviations from Keplerian motion to constrain also the... and that has... I'll show how that has has been added. 1068, as I mentioned, is not such a good example. It's not an example of such a good Keplerian motion.
The line of notes is not along the line of sight in 4258, because the reason that the systemic masers are all at the same radius is that the whole thing folds over. Yeah. You're seeing a caustic group facing.
Yeah, no, I will come to that. I'm glad you mentioned, but that was what I was kind of hinting at, and I will come back to that, yeah. This is 1068. This is the apparent distribution, which initially, this is the center, and initially people thought this is like the wall of that proverbial torus. But later this point was found, and as you see, it lies on more or less what would look like an extension of this curve. So it's not quite Keplerian, but quasi-Keplerian, kind of dropping with radius. And from this one gets a mass of about 10 to the 7 solar masses.
That curve, I think, is about part of the minus 0.3.
That's right, 0.35 or 0.3. And there are some recent papers in the literature which very carefully attempt to model that, which I think is a little premature, right? It looks like it's up, yeah, but I wouldn't take it to, I don't think that we have anywhere enough data to take it too seriously, but certainly it drops.
I think it requires a lot of phase to believe that the lower
carrots. Maybe, depending on your religious inclinations, I didn't need that much faith in that. But, I mean, it's right here.
I think the fair way to put it is that if you just put the right hand down and reflect it, that's what they're drawing.
Yeah.
And it does happen to pass. So it's not that
bad. Notice that there's this region here where the velocity grows linearly, which would be consistent with seeing Hello? You're talking about mega maser disks in active galactic nuclei. So it's true to itself. Notice that this linear growth is consistent with basically seeing a constant radius with rotating, which would be like the inner radius of a disk, just in projection, because rotating with a given angular velocity, and the radial velocity is just the cosine theta projection. So that would just rise linearly with projected distance. You look puzzled.
Yeah.
So let me.
I don't have.
So here is if you look from here. So here these are the high velocity measures along the mid plane, which would be just v phi. Say you see directly the velocity, and it drops in a Keplerian or quasi Keplerian. Here you're seeing a linear growth would be just if you had a constant angle of velocity and you just moved away from the center. And so that would, the fact that we see them over a larger range than in 4258 means that there is some radio emission that can possibly can just amplify the inner edge can amplify some background source that extends not just to the center but in a larger angular range. And that seems to be consistent with the observations in 1068. So first, of an ionized inner edge that was discovered up to scales of like 0.5 parsecs. So again, here is a larger scale molecular disk which you see going down to one and about one arc second resolution. So this would be the scales on, this would be that molecular distribution which is pretty much in this horizontal plane perpendicular to that jet. And here again we see that here is the disk and here is the jet axis, pretty much this is now on scale of the parsec, and you see this is now this has been interpreted as evidence for ionized the inner edge of that disk on similar scales to what I've been showing you. So if indeed there's a radio emission in this inner edge, possibly just the ionized inner edge, that could be amplified along the rim and give rise to those linearly rising features. But I'm emphasizing that because there is seems to be evidence in 1068 that there is such a structure on such similar scales of a few tenths of a parsec which has an ionized
ratio.
It's continuum.
But the top you're showing us
the top are molecular lines.
And can you also remind us when we're looking at water or freezer, what kind of temperature medium are we looking at?
I'm coming to that.
Okay.
Okay, so the one thing that I wanted to emphasize right away is to look at this and look back at the maser. And you notice that, I mean, these are actually the, so this is the molecular line distribution, and this is the jet. But these are the masers. This is the same coordinate. It's about, let's say, roughly splitting the difference. That's about 45 or 35 degrees, somewhere in that range. You see, if this were the main disk, it just, the whole, our whole paradigm would just collapse. Because it's not at right angle to the jet, and it wouldn't be at right angle to that electric vectors. And this wouldn't be consistent at this oriented like that would not be consistent with the with our paradigm. And 1068 has been the source on which the paradigm, the unification scheme has grown. So
what about Pringle's paradigm?
Which one?
Pringle, could it be warped out?
Yeah, well, but I'm still talking about the orientation. what, yeah, no, I don't see how anything of that diagram that I showed from Pringle would correspond to that. These are actually the measure.
Where we see the reflected light is on scales between about 10 and 100 parsecs. That's actually resolved in HSTM chemistry. So, in principle, you could have it tilted like that at a parsec, and then other stuff at 10 parsecs that was oriented to work to make the polarization come more back, right? But you need some dynamics to do that.
Yeah, you can say that the Pringle's model can't explain this, but I think that the ground is going to have to be looked at carefully. There's so many things that could go on in that model that you could probably get something to look at. The question is how special is the parameters.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still, of course, if everything can go, then why not? But remember that these measures, as I will also show again, when we discuss the emission properties, they need some very special. So in some sense, this must be a locus of points that have a sufficiently large gain along the line of sight. So why in that picture that would be arranged along a more or less plane, and it's not obvious to me. But there are also other. Your point is well taken, children, but I thought that in the case of 1068, the implication, even from your own work, if I remember correctly, that where the location of the scatter is, it's not that much high above the scales that we are talking about now.
Well, that's measured as such in these HST images.
Yes.
And that's read anywhere from a few tens to maybe as much as 100 parsecs up. So it is, you know, one order of magnitude farther away. And
okay.
You
know, yeah.
Maybe you can have a tilt, maybe Pringle's mechanism does it.
But also notice that this is now the measurement of the ionized emission, and that's on similar scales. And
fits very neatly inside the
Right. No, it fits both neatly inside the mesoscope, that's right, but also fits neatly with the large scale flattened distribution locally of the molecular.
It may well be that the inner disk is the thing that's warped and the outer disk is the boundary condition. I mean, the masers might be the flat disk, that's the boundary condition, because those scales of one parsec are several times larger already than the disk in 4258.
No, but we are talking about the disk in 1068.
1068 is a much more luminous source, but it's still...
But we are now comparing the scale here of that inner disk with the scale of the maser disk, which is about the same.
Yeah, the other thing that's about that scale...
Here it is.
There's another thing that's just about that scale, and that's the K-band point source that's seen in spectral imaging. So the warmest dust is also about a half parsec from the center.
That's right.
That all hangs together very nicely.
Yeah, which is nice. So we have all come to kind of like and appreciate that unification scheme, but this just flies right in your eye at 45 degrees. So
okay.
we would...
But no, when you said, you know, my stuff is suggesting parsec scale, that was based on luminosity of 10 to 44, and just scales up the luminosity, you know, more.
Yeah, but it's not that, much bigger, right? Yeah.
And there it all hangs together.
Okay.
The larger scale.
Okay. So please bear this in mind, because I will try to address that. Okay, so now to the question that Doug was asking, what is actually exciting the masers? It's through various arguments that I won't go into, but various papers go into. There's this paper by Litsura and McKee last year that discusses all the options and disposes of them. It's believed that these masers are pumped collisionally. The other options are radiative pumping, but that's unlikely here. So for optimal masing conditions, and I'll be talking about saturated masers and various arguments in this paper that I mentioned to you why they could be mildly saturated, but it's really this ballpark should be right. The characteristic densities for exciting such masers are 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 particles per cc, temperatures which exceed 250 degrees, and fractional water abundances of like 10 to the minus 5 to 10 to the minus 4. And furthermore, in the case of an AGN, which typical spectrum like in 1068 or And we have actually, for whatever application that we did here, we actually used the actual spectrum to do the calculation. But something like 10 to the 22, 10 to the 23 shielding column, nominal shielding column, to dispose of the very high energy photons that would kill, that would just dissociate the molecules. So you need a shield. If you want to excite them by a radiation field, you need a shielding column, and then densities, temperatures, and fractional water abundances in this range. And the proposed models has the one that has been originally proposed by Neuffel and Maloney really exciting things radiatively. So the idea here is that you have to expose the gas to the radiation field. That's where the warp comes in. You warp the disk so it becomes exposed to the central continuum. And then as it's being, you get a cross-section very close to the central source. For example, let's say so in this picture, the inner radius of the disk is just where the warp starts. The inner radius of the mesodisc is 0.13 parsecs or so in 4258 or 0.18 parsec in 1068. That's where the warp would start. Then as you then move out, you have an upper layer which is atomic and an inner interior layer which is molecular, where the pressure is a bit higher. And then as you go out in such a standard Capern disk, the pressure drops fast enough that the whole medium becomes atomic, and so that's what they identify as the outer region of the disk. There are no more molecules. As I'll show you, the picture that I'll be discussing identifies the outer radius with a different idea. But that's what they said. That's what they were using. And they may not be an inner radius. So that's an excellent point. So that's maybe a good time to flash this thing that I was saying earlier. The original warp disk model had assumed that there was just some fixed tilt. I mean, because you saw these systemic masses below the midline, you knew that there was some, you're not looking exactly at the flat, but there was some orientation that they were like at 82 degrees rather than 90 degrees. But in along the line of sight, the model was very simple. It was just basically a straight line, and the question, there was no variation of the inclination with radius, and the question was, well, why do you see the masers confined just to a narrow range and where they are? So there are two questions. Why they appear here, and that was interpreted as just the inner edge of a disk, and why are they confined to a narrow range in radius, and that wasn't really well explained. So the new kind of, you'd say, natural picture was really to take this whole thing and assume a more general description, basically vary the inclination with radius. That's this preprint of Fernstein et al. And that addresses your question of what they did. They just said, let's look at the deviations of this high-velocity masses from pure Keplerian motion, and let's try to correct it. And one way, the best correction, if they just took a simple linear variation, di is constant plus some constant times r, they got some parameter that was the best fitting to this deviation. Then they said, what would that look now if we looked at it along our line of sight? And lo and behold, that's what it would look like. And there's this wonderful gain in the path length, or caustic, or ball, or what have you, or limb brightening effect, just when you're looking right here. And that happens to be just at the location of the systemic measure, and we'll explain why it's such a narrow range, because that large gain is just confined to a small region.
Can they tell whether the locus of the line of nose is prograde or retrograde?
I don't know. I mean, they may, but I don't know the answer.
That's a key discriminant for whether Pringle's theory works or not.
Okay.
It's got to be prograde.
Okay.
I believe it is Bergen. I talked to Jim about that. But that was a while ago, so I don't know whether the final fit for Bergen.
So, interestingly enough, in this type of a model, basically at double that radius, which is also coincidentally the outer edge of this meso disk, this disk, if you just believed it, this picture would cross the line of sight again. And so in their picture, so I'm kind of just telling you in advance, just apropos, in their picture that could be therefore contributor to the X-ray absorption. And what they did, they said, let's take the X-ray absorbing column, and this would give us an upper limit on the mass accretion rate for the disk, because if you had too much, you would overdo the absorption. And then there's a minimum accretion rate just to keep it molecular up to that radius. And surprisingly, those two numbers are about the same. And based on that, you know, the simplest picture of just a homogeneous disk basically gives you an accretion rate and efficiency which are not, on the face of it, consistent with advection-dominated models. So if I...
What are the estimates?
The efficiency is 0.05, and the accretion rate is very similar to what Meloni and Neufeld... Because
the efficiency is 0.05.
0.05.
Of course, with the disk that thin and that large, there's no reason to believe that there should be a steady, that there's time for a steady state to be established.
Yeah, no, of course. But I'm just amazed that this, and I'll give you some other arguments why a homogeneous model isn't right for that, but it flies in the face of all those things. The simplest model seems to be giving perfectly consistent results, and so I start to believe that this archetypal source 42-58 is probably the one that's different from all the rest of them.
But then you have to explain the infrared.
Yeah, no, so you, yeah, maybe the infrared is not right. The aperture is big. Yeah. But yes, but I just wanted to bring it to your attention, and in particular to point out that in this picture you don't need an inner edge anymore for this source.
Yeah, so it's trying to distress all the previous.
For this source, but not for 42, yeah. Yeah, we do. There's a very recent paper, again, that I just got over the weekend from Rotheron, and apparently Antonucci and others here are involved in, on again, doing spectral polarimetry now, again, narrow line, looking at the narrow line region. It's an unusual source also that the narrow lines are highly polarized. There's only one such other Seifert node. And it seems like it's consistent with this 10 to the 42 thereabouts. But, can you measure what?
Yeah.
Well, no, you can't. I mean, you can get a limit on the accretion efficiency, but you have to pick an alpha. I'm not sure how you would get an alpha. Okay. The other, so if you have a warp, just another comment here. Mitch probably told you, or is in best position to tell you about the radiation pressure-induced instability discussed in these papers. I believe it's true, right, that for that instability does demand and there's a maximum, there's a minimum radius where the warp would start. So if really there is no inner radius, then you can question that. That
radius is probably well inside where the warp starts at 42-58. And what we suggested was we were just looking at the time-dependent evolution of the warp. So the warp in this instability, the warp starts in the outer parts and then grows inwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other issue that has been addressed by various people, most recently by Gemi et al., the issue of whether the spectrum of the source can be modeled by, and Lasota, of course, et al. Initially, whether this spectrum can be modeled by an ADAF model. And that looks to be, there's an argument that possibly this radiation pressure induced instability is not consistent with an ADAF model, but in our paper we have an appendix where we argue that there's a way to reconcile those two. And of course, again, this was mentioned several times, and one cannot tire from saying it, that the scales are sufficiently distant that there's no reason why, but simple-minded astrophysicists just want to have everything covered in one model. But there's no reason why the accretion rate currently seen on scales of 0.1 parsec should be what's currently seen on scales of 100 Schwarzschild radian. Right. The alternative to that was modeled by McKee and by Maoz and McKee, which is rather than being, that model does not require any warps, that in this case the emission, the Mesa emission is excited simply by collisionally by shock waves. And so they propose this spiral shock model. The origin of those shocks in a non-self-gravitating disk is left open. I mean, something has to excite, some disturbance has to excite them. And they resort to quotations from different notable scientists who told them that it is not implausible. But this addresses two interesting features. First of all, why are those mesas grouped in little discrete clumps? And this would be nicely answered here. The other option, the other interesting prediction here is that you would see predominance of red-shifted mesas, stronger and more red-shifted than blue-shifted, because if you have trailing spiral waves, you see emission that goes in the blue-shifted direction would pass through a column here of absorbing non-mesing gas and would be reduced. Most very, very recently, there's been an abstract in the recent AES meeting by Bragg et al., the CFA crowd, claiming that two of the predictions of this model, this predicts a certain acceleration. This whole pattern is rotating, and there's a little acceleration, which shouldn't have been measurable on such short timescales, but the CFA people claim that they did measure it, and it's inconsistent. Probably they measured something else, and this prediction here is still in the noise. But the other thing that they claim, which I just saw the word in the abstract, is that this prediction that the red-shifted would be always in front of the midline and the blue-shifted would be behind the midline is also not right. That's what they claim. So I don't know. But that model is would be a question.
Can you remind us, what is the bandwidth, the individual components of the
data? Bandwidth in terms of the
velocity.
Oh, so, well, I showed you some of the spectra.
Yeah.
They are, you know, I would say tens of kilometers per second.
Maybe. Individualized tens of kilometers.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, the actual velocities are 1,000.
Yeah, right.
So, something on that range.
Are you changing the results? You can't really identify.
Well, there are features. You identify features. And
yeah, so they get the centroid velocity for each spot. Can they actually define the profile for each spot as well?
Well, you can say maybe there's more information there that you don't see, but you certainly see certain features.
More like 1 kilometer per second, a little bit less. 10 kilometers per second is a bit larger to get that in the coherence.
So maybe more like a 1 kilometer, yeah. Maybe more like a 1. Yeah, more like
that. And they can identify individual major spots, which I think they can resolve. And they say that there seems to be some physical reality to them. They don't seem to move at any, they seem to move at exactly the blurring
speed. Yeah, no, that's a very old thing about it.
That's right. I think that has implications for this.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's got to be one. They always have 10% scatter around.
That's right. Yeah, more like one. That's right. So you kind of, these are the spectra, so you just said. I mean, of course, those other inferences about the acceleration are just from measuring it over a period of time. But, okay. What are the, let me leave this diagram because I will show you something else. So just to move on, since I want to get to some new stuff. So why this is interesting? Because these are, perhaps with the exception of our own galactic center, this is 4258, is our best example to date of an actual supermassive black hole in an active galactic nucleus. So much mass on such a small scale is really very hard to explain in any other way. There's also the distance determinations, which I indicated. But what I would like to focus on is really probing what those measures can tell us about accretion, this accretion process, and kind of by implication about our paradigm. So let me take you quickly about with some very general and not really go into the details, some ideas about what are the general flux constraints for measures. So very generally, flux is intensity times solid angle, written in this fashion in terms of a brightness temperature. For saturated measures, the brightness temperature is scales as the aspect ratio cube. And the aspect ratio is just the length along the line of sight and the effective over the effective radius. So it's really a beaming effect, a very strongly beaming beam radiation, depending on how elongated. Even slight elongation of the masers really increases their brightness by a lot. And you can write it in terms of, so just writing it in terms of the projected distance from the center, which is measurable, and then the aspect ratio and this length over the radius from the center. And now let's assume that we actually have a Keplerian disk. So just imagine in this diagram we have a Keplerian disk. And we can, in order for the elements in a certain distance to amplify each other, they have to be in velocity coherent, which means that the difference in projected velocity along the line of sight has to be less than about the width of the line. So for a Keplerian disk, this is simple to derive. So let's say you are exactly looking at along the line of sight in the mid-plane. There's the coherence half-width and coherence half-length, which would be essentially define the size of the box from which the emission can come coherently. And typically, numbers are like few by 10 to the 14 centimeters for the width and 10 to the 16 centimeters for the length. And of course, you need the height for the box, but that's determined by your resolution usually. So doing that, you can now ask yourself, what is the maximum emission that I can get? Just substitute the coherence box dimensions to get the aspect ratio. And then the expression really simplifies, completely in terms of observables. So this is the distance in units of 10 milliarc seconds. This is the delta V, the width over the line of sight velocity, normalize it 10 to the minus 3, typical number. And you expect something on the order of Jansky, quite generally. And not always, but frequently from the few sources that we have, this is much larger than what we observe. Especially in 1068, this is about an order of magnitude larger than the actual flux that we measure. And that is already a first and important argument that says that only a fraction of the permissible emitting volume is emitting, which suggests that what something else physically, locally, determines the size of the emission rather than just the pure Keplerian, just the pure fact that you have a Keplerian disk. For example, the spiral shock picture is one such possibility because it does determine locally by some other physics the emission region. In the case of 4258, by the way, this argument actually isn't so strong. You actually are consistent, nearly consistent with the maximum flux. But in the 4258, there's another issue. If you just take a purely Keplerian velocity law, you would expect the flux by this argument would drop very rapidly with the line of sight velocity, just by putting in the different radii, translating them into velocities dependencies. and that's not observed. In fact, we see one sees much lower decrease in velocities, or sometimes even an increase in line of sight velocity. So, again, even in 4258, it may not something else may be there organizing it, but which is not just this simple kinematic direction. So the implication that I would take from here, just as a hypothesis, and maybe I'll pursue it to its extreme, but maybe too extremely, but nevertheless, that the disk is clumped. And this, of course, is consistent with the images. One sees little features, spectral features in the systemic masers moving along the line of sight. One sees the high variability. So that certainly is consistent with different patches. Now, what are those clumps? Of course, they could be just velocity irregularities. So it could be just a turbulent medium. And some people, like this was proposed originally in galactic context by Deguchi, but more recently Wallen et al. Have applied it to the extragalactic case. Just trying to basically take realizations, Monte Carlo realizations of a turbulent medium and see if one can reproduce the spectra. So it could be that you have a homogeneous medium with little velocity irregularities, and what you see are just those, and the density is basically uniform. The other extreme case is that you actually have discrete condensations, which are very different, that there is that the maser features are really discrete gas condensations or clouds. So let me pursue this one now. Let's assume that really, let's just pursue that kind of to its logical or illogical extreme. Let's assume that we have, that what we see are really discrete gas condensations. And what kind of motivates it is that the parameters that we infer for the densities and even number densities of those clouds are pretty consistent with what one infers for broad emission line region clouds. But at the end of the day, we could maybe go back and say that maybe there are no broad emission line clouds, and maybe indeed the broad emission line region is some kind of a turbulent, irregular type medium and not discrete cloud.
What are the physical reasons why you should have clouds in this rather coldish, not strongly related to this?
I've hard time giving physical reasons for, I mean, in some scenarios it's easier, but I don't want to, yeah, that's something that I'm opening up as a question. I don't know.
What is the Mach number of this gas, the major gas? If you orbital velocity of Earth,
of course, it's if you move at 1,000 kilometers per second and the sun speed is, the temperatures are for the 1,000 degrees or less, these are huge. Yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah. Right. But they also seem to have ordered motions.
Yeah.
So I'll show you that there are scenarios where this is not in, that some scenarios where this could work. And I'm kind of heading towards picture of clouds as one extreme, and I'm anticipating that Julian maybe tomorrow will have something to say about clouds, maybe for clumpy disks further in.
Actually, I'm not going to talk about that.
Okay, well, so maybe we can talk about it anyway.
Well, I think I'm worried.
I'm not talking about the bouncing clouds, but about the clumped inner regions of. Yeah.
Okay. That would have been a reasonable supposition to the title, but not
okay. Okay. So we'll look forward to some new exciting things, but nevertheless, you can tell us about that.
The simulation of magnetized clouds actually shows it to be kind of like.
Okay, so suppose you actually, so let's assume that we actually have emission from clouds. Let's take one characteristic cloud, and I'll argue that characteristic scales would be of order 10 to the 13 centimeters. I'll tell you momentarily why. And characteristic distances, characteristic kind of fiducial aspect ratios. you get a flux which is like a millionth or 10 to the minus 5 of a Jansky, utterly negligible for what we need, which is of order Janskys or so, or 0.1 Jansky. But what's really interesting is that if you take two such flux and put them along the line of sight and separate them by something on the order of 10 to the 16 centimeters, you cannot go too far because this breaks down, but within those reasonable dimensions of 10 to the 16 centimeters, you can produce the entire flux that is observed in any given feature by just two clamps along the line of sight. And in fact, for a given flux, normalized by 0.1 Janskys, you can ask yourself what has to be the minimum separation. And you find out that this is for the 10 to the 16 centimeters. And then you say, okay, for self-consistency, that minimum separation has to be less than the length or half length. And interestingly, that turns out to be true for the two cases where we have numbers, both 4258 and 1068, but not by much, very close. So maybe what this is telling us is that there is a reason for the fact that we, strengthening the reason for the fact that we see those sources preferentially in super two-type galaxies. It tells you that in order to, for two such features to self-amplify, they really have to be separated by the, nearly the maximum length that is allowable if you look at 90 degrees. So there's a strong observational bias for, in this picture for seeing those sources when they are nearly along the plane of the disk is nearly along the line of sight. That's right. Oh, you wouldn't see two of them separated by sufficient distance. Right. Yeah. So okay. So if, since it, the numbers seem to work, let's continue this mad chase and say take it further and say, well, suppose what is the minimum number of clouds that I need for them to overlap, and I get a number. And this number is, so that would be the number density of clouds in that region, which is about the broadline region. And it's not too different from the numbers that people like Arav et al. Get from the cross correlation of lines. So again, we are treading here on delicate waters because the numbers are consistent, but of course, if you increase those numbers just a little bit, this whole photoionization model becomes questionable. It's already on the verge. So either meaning that you can you can play a little bit with some of those like how what would be the ionization fraction and I mean the ionization parameter and how to relate that to the number. So Roger can comment on that. But no, it's here where they are consistent. They are within an order of magnitude. Yeah. So if you really have a lot of, so there's a lot of clouds, but they are still consistent. And the densities, of course, are also consistent. We are, the number densities of broad emission line regions is just what basically what you need for the for optimal mazing.
I mean, if you think each band is extremely similar. The ones that brought the line using the
cellular sensors being very small. That's right, but I will actually show you a mental construct where this would be the large cousins of smaller clouds.
Yeah.
Okay, even more, and of course this is, in this picture of course it's natural and good to, easy to account for observed flux variability. So before moving to specific disk model scenarios, let me point out some really interesting analogies in this picture with galactic mazes. First of all, so here is 3079, there's a more recent work on Cercinus galaxies. So we talked about, this is not very illuminating and it's confusing, but this has been, just from velocity measurement, this axis has been interpreted as corresponding to a disk. And there's also evidence for mazes excited along jet. There's several such sources now where there's evidence for mazes along jets, not in a disk.
Is there a relation to the stuff in the Z box?
The insert box is just, I think, takes, you can read the captions because I don't remember. I think it's just one of those. It's taking this and just magnifying it. And that's taken to be the center of activity.
So how did you define that dash line labeled disk?
I'm not going to go into that. I don't want to take the time. But basically, that's based on velocity. I mean, on this velocity measurement, that they more or less fit into some kind of. Let me show you the velocity information they have for the galactic salt, which is very similar. So that would.
That sure doesn't look like a nice thin.
No, nothing looks nice and thin. But this, a similar kind of inference was made for the Sinus galaxy. These are not very clean observations, but they are. Here's a galactic counterpart. You wouldn't guess, again, like in many of those things that I made, that they appear on such different scales and look so similar. And even though I promised Roger I won't say a word about anything at Z less than 0.01 or something.
Where's the black hole?
Oh, that's right. You know, there are some people who try to interpret young stars.
I don't know. We were talking about binary scenario. You don't get it.
No, it's, yeah. Okay. So I'm glad.
No, but where's the black hole?
Yeah. No, that's a good question. Some people are trying to use black hole models for the young stars to your delight, and yeah. So again, here it's just based on kind of the Julian, kind of similar velocity information. It doesn't where this is kind of like a disk, and this is more or less kind of like a. Anyway, so there is something that has been identified. You can read the arguments with the disk. Again, these are water masers in our own galaxy.
Like I said, reassure the people in other areas are as sloppy as we are.
Well, you can be reassured that the quality of the observations is as good in AGNs as it is in stars. But this is, of course, so these are major observations in galactic sources. More to the interesting even is the fact that if you take the brightest water major source in our galaxy, which is W49N, and it has a quiescent state and has outbursts every so often. Those outbursts have been also modeled recently in terms of overlapping clouds, Bobols et al., 99. But if you look at the fluxes for 49N, there are about few by 10 to the 4 Jansky's. And if you now scale this to 11 kiloparsecs or to 7 megaparsecs, for 1068 and 4258, you get within less than an order of magnitude to the fluxes that we just see. This is basically the same thing. You can have two overlapping clouds if that's what it is, but even irrespective of what it is, the numbers are, it's basically the same, could be the same phenomenon. In some sense, you could say that what we see in the extragalactic sources would be the flares that we see locally.
Yeah, are the inferred densities fairly?
Absolutely, because that's if they're inferred to be collisionally pumped, so the 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9. Yes, and temperatures. Of course, here they may be in the lock, either all kinds of small shocks or local radiation field of massive star on much smaller scales, but nevertheless, the physical conditions in the emission region are extremely similar. So, interesting. So, let's take this now to 1068. And let's take the simplest, let's just say we don't know, we have kind of wrecked our heads on this and that, all kinds of astrophysical scenarios, and each one of them, after many weeks and months of labor, turned out to have some basic flaw that just doomed it. Let's just go the other way around. Let's ask ourselves phenomenologically what it is that we need to account for the observations in a source like 1068. So let's assume since we take the clumpy picture, let's assume that we basically have a disk of clumps. Let's just make it completely flat. It's in this picture, it's oriented more or less to fit the 1068 picture, but has an ionized inner region, the radiojet, but these are not you know, this is just for illustration. There is an interclamp medium here, but that doesn't play really much of a role. Let's just assume that we have a disk of clamp and ask ourselves, what are the constraints that one needs to satisfy to account for the mazes? And again, let me lead you through that quickly, because it's, yeah. So first of all, let's assume that we have a collection of cylindrical mazing clouds of some radius RC and density and temperature lying in a planar ring, like here. And just to make it simple, we adopt this geometric picture. So first of all, we need the gas to be molecular. That's the same argument as Neufeld and Al had. And you can think of it, as Meloni et al. Explained in the paper, in terms of like an effect like the generalization of the ionization parameter, flux over Cp, except it is generalized with the shielding column density, which you need in the AGNs. So you need to have a certain ionization parameter effectively to give you a certain maximum temperature to be molecular. Or, in other words, you have to have a certain minimum shielding column to get to be molecular, as I already indicated. Turns out from this expressions that this column is roughly inversely proportional to the density. So we have a certain, so the first constraint is that in order to be molecular, the shielding column has to be greater than some minimum shielding, some minimum value, n min. Now, the other constraint that is the temperature. If you have too much of a, as you, of course, increase the column, the effective ionization parameter goes down and the temperature goes down. It can't go down too much, because if it goes down below 250 degrees, you again won't maze. So there's a maximum column, again, roughly proportional inversely to the density, which will tell you what the shielding is. In our picture, that would determine the maximum radius. The whole region is, we take a bunch of molecular clouds, gas that could be molecular but would not maze beyond a certain region just because its temperature is too low. Now,
are we optically thick and thin compared here, or are we optically?
There is, for an individual cloud, you are optically thin. So there's this whole argument of Wallin and Watson about how you can compete, just like an argument for broad emission line region that it terminates where the dust is, because the dust competes for the ionizing photon. Here you can do the same thing for infrared pumping photon and increase the effective region where you can maze. But because we have clouds that are individually optically thin, that argument is not relevant. So I'm not considering it. But you can, okay. So now we go back to the idea that the emission that we see from the flux from a given feature, high velocity feature here, has to do with two overlapping clamps. And we deduce a certain minimum number density for clamps. And remember, these are scales of 10 to the 16 centimeters. But now, those whole clouds are present there, and there's a whole region in this mazing disk, which 10 to the 18 centimeters, which would also be covered with clouds, and you start have to worry whether those clouds would self-shield. So the other concern is you now have to decree that this central, so you can, you know, write an expression for the shielding to the center, and you want that shielding to be less than n max, that self-shielding less than n max, otherwise you won't see the mazing emission. Final constraint has to do with the maser emission measure, which is kind of like an optical depth effect. In order to maze this parameter, which is normalized here in terms of the water abundance, the density, units of 10 to the 9, and the radius in 10 to the 13, has to be greater than 1. And that's where they, so if you take it to be characteristically 1 and 10 to the 9 here, that's a typical radius of 10 to the 13 comes about. So radii of 10 to the 13, 10 to the 14 are expected. And the final argument for a source like 1068 is that if you really have a bunch of dusty clouds and you have a very strong source here, which is well above the local dust adding to luminosity. You have to have enough column here in everything to prevent the stuff from being blown away. And so you have a number like, you have to have a column greater than 10 to the 21, basically times the fraction, how many critical luminosities enter into the bolometric luminosity. So putting all this together, and then this is just to show that for each case we take the actual spectrum to calculate those effective ionization parameters. The ambient disk is non-present here. We just have clouds in this picture. Just this is the minimal kind of model. And so putting all this on a phase diagram, which is the column density is the function of the water abundance. So here is the N max. This is where the temperature drops below 250 degrees. This is N min to be molecular. So you have to be in this range. This is all calculated for the conditions, the radii and the luminosities of 1068 in the mass. This is where you have to be. This is the self-shielding. So the self-shielding has to lie between these two, and so you see there's a range above it that is consistent. So this region that is consistent is somewhere between, these are the water abundances. And now you say, okay, given these conditions, luminosities and shielding, what would be the actual water abundance and temperature? So now this is taking a slightly different calculation, but consistent, rather than a collection of clouds, taking a given slab where the front and back interact with each other. So it's not exactly the same calculation, but it's close. And just allow radiation to fall in and see what abundances you get. And you see typically you get water abundances of 10 to the minus 5. So you go back to this diagram, 10 to the minus 5 is here, and it's comfortably between these two plots, which you can be here next to this maximum shielding column, and some other material can help you shield. So overall, it looks like this very simple construction is consistent for 1068. If you do the same thing for 4258, you find that it's not consistent, because basically the self-shielding of the clouds kills you. Again, you get water abundances of 10 to the minus 5, but for 10 to the minus 5 here, you see the self-shielding is well above the maximum. So you just want the, this picture would not be self-consistent.
Did you take the warp into account?
No, there's no warp here. This is the simplest. Of course, with warp, it would, but this is just assuming the simplest picture. So
artistically, do we have to shade in the allowed region, or?
Well, the reason it wasn't shaded, you have to be above that.
Little arrow.
Okay, thanks. The reason that it wasn't shaded is because for each density you get different lines. So
these parameters, do you run into this issue that Colin Kumar raised about self-gravity being important?
I will mention Kumar's work. No, not here. Yeah. This is a tiny disk. So that's in fact my next point, which is that for 4268 you can play little games. You can assume that possibly you get the water abundance is enhanced a little bit because of evaporation of icy mantles which hydrogenated back in the disk. But even that wouldn't quite work. Still the abundance for typical, and this has been involved in our own interstellar medium, but even that wouldn't quite work. But the point that I really want to emphasize is, after all is said and done for this very simple model, you ask yourself, well, what did I find? What are the parameters of the disk? And then at some point I woke up in the middle of the night and said, by golly, it looks so familiar. Why didn't I realize it immediately that I've seen that movie before? And that movie is in our own galactic center. in fact, the parameters of this simple model for this ring in 1068 are extremely similar to what people infer in the circumnuclear disk in the galactic center. Particular, so here is some, you know, pictures what Gensel 10 years ago has pictured the galactic center slightly tilted. It's tilted with respect to the plane and warped, slightly warped, sharp inner edge. And just to remind you the parameters, it's a inferred 10 to the 4 solar mass. It's on slightly larger scales, indeed, than a few parsecs larger than what we are looking here, but the masses are about the same, 10 to the 4. So you see that's highly, you know, non-subgravitating.
For those of us who are ignorant and forgetful, where are those very infrared stars? Are they?
Right here.
What is 10 to the 4?
Yeah, okay.
10
to the 4 solar masses.
So
the mass of that ring.
Mass
of the ring. Of the disk. It's in the gravitational field of... It's in the gravitational field. It doesn't dominate globally, the gravitational field.
Okay,
and locally, you can calculate the...
The
not so much the Turing parameter, but you can calculate the tidal density.
Yeah, right.
It's geometrically probably
Here there's no temperature. I'm just saying, what's the... Assume that you have self-gravitating clamp, and will it be torn apart by the... So it's not the tumor parameter, it's the just the tidal density.
Oh, so it's not the same thing as people call it.
No, it's not. You ask yourself, what would be the density?
So you know the Rand speed and the vertical gravity have to be an interesting fraction of the circular speed. Mm-hmm. And with the mass this much smaller than the central mass, it's not going to be self-gravitating locally.
Okay, this is for the
That sketch is actually based on real imaging.
Sure.
No, but just to emphasize, you can ask yourself what you can look at it. You can take a little sphere and ask yourself what would be m over r cubed.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you find the density that would withstand tidal is about 10 to the 8, which is just about the densities that we get both here and in the galactic center. So you could say maybe it's a coincidence, maybe not. It's not. Those scales are not large enough to be a Jeans mass. You have to have some to really form a Jeans mass. It's much larger. But you can imagine something that was already massive and got disrupted, and these little clamps that are the Mayser clamps would now be able to withstand further tidal shearing because the densities are just right. So. In other words, I don't know how they form, but once they form, they can be remain stable, somewhat long-lived in that distance. Yeah. So maybe it's not a coincidence that these are the densities that on those scales are stabilized, but I mean can maintain themselves by self-gravity. But interestingly, also in the case of the galactic disk, even though you read usually that the mean density is like 10 to the 5 or so, when you actually look at the paper by Jackson et al, they list the various components, the highest density component has essentially the same contribution when you multiply it by the filling factor as the rest of it. And the filling factors are very similar to what we infer, 10 to minus 3 to the minus 8. In our own galactic center, there are components that go to 10 to the 8. And the area covering factor is 0.1. Interestingly, in those papers on the galactic center, they emphasize that there's no signature that they have of an interclamp medium. And, okay, the other thing that's interesting in the galactic center that there's evidence on larger radii, a few hundreds of parsecs, for a rotating bar, and there's, in fact, evidence for mass streaming into the disk. It has also an sharp ionized inner edge at 1.5 parsec, and there's also, as you know, in our own galactic center, evidence for mass inflow at roughly the same rate interior to that. But in the case of 1068, interestingly enough, there's also evidence for a bar, rotating bar, that feeds mass to the center. That's work of Helfer and Blitz, and the Mazur ring rotation axis is approximately parallel to that bar. So I will have another 10 minutes to go. Is that okay?
I wonder if we'll go off 2 hours.
Okay. Well, I will. Okay. So I will try to speed it up.
No, I'm true to.
I want to be true to my own principles. So it's, okay. So the puzzles. I list. You know, there are all those. Really, at this point, it's really a question. More questions than answers. There's, are those transient phenomena? Are we happening to see mass that is being fed to the disk? Now, in ten, source like 1068. The argument, this is not now not the main disk. This is some kind of a transient, very low mass phenomenon that could be in this. Could it be that this is really transient? And what we just happen to see is something that just aligns properly in the plane that we can see it as Mazur. Is this ring interpretation also applicable to something like 4258? What is the origin of this sharp inner edge? There are various arguments, but now that we see, if we really adopt for the moment that these are very similar pictures, there's something that appears twice already, it becomes a question. What is it? Now, what is this relation of that to this large-scale disk that we think does exist in the, according to this unification scheme? What if there's this massive disk there in the center? How would it interact with? Why wouldn't it disrupt that thing? And that's where Kumar's work comes, and Mitch is asked about this issue. Very recently, Kumar has taken the 1068, is given luminosity, given mass. He applied just a viscous disk model and said, what would be the kind of model that I would get in order to account for the luminosity in that mass, in the field of this particular central mass? And he finds, infers that that disk has to be very massive and possibly would therefore be self-gravitating and clamped. This is Kumar. Now, I tried to use that instant where you escape to get to that. The question is, how would that ring interact possibly with the large-scale mass? And Kumar is deducing that if you took a large-scale disk, which was viscous in this luminosity and mass, it would fragment. So if it did fragment, that may be an answer. There would be a large-scale fragments and a ring that... so if it fragmented, there would be less... more probability that this ring could survive. But again, it's still an issue. And what is the origin of the clumpiness? Are we talking about turbulent medium? Is there a dynamically significant interclump medium? There's a whole issue, and that then brings to the question of could there be accretion disks which are clumpian? There's been some earlier work here by Mitch and Julian, who's not talking about it tomorrow, and Kumar. But at least this earlier work, so the work of Mitch and Schlossmann was very interesting. They predicted, in fact, that there would be clumping on this similar on such scales. But this had to do with much more massive disks, self-gravitating disks.
They were not radially self-gravitating, they were vertically self-gravitating.
Weren't they also globally self-gravitating?
There's
a contribution to the...
The different samples are each different. 4258 is clearly very thin.
Yeah.
And the black at center is fairly thick. In 1068, we thought it was thick, but the Mazur distribution is thin.
So, again, so maybe they are... Right, so maybe they form... I'm still not exactly, it's not entirely clear to me how this is related to the large scale flow, because we obviously have an equatorial massive disk there, and also this kind of presumably much less massive features that give rise to this tilted meso disk. But yeah, so question is, if you have such a clump disk, how does it transfer angular momentum? Is it just by collisions, or maybe magnetic fields now can play a role?
This may also be a place to interject another comment. And I think 1068 differs in a qualitative way from both the galactic center and 4258, in that it's a much more luminous system.
Mm-hmm.
If you take that nominal mass estimate, the b squared r, mm-hmm. 1068, and compare it to bolometric, L over LA is close to unity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's right, that's
since
right.
The dust opacity is very large compared to Thompson. Mm-hmm. You know, expected radiation forces would be very important in 1068,
mm-hmm.
even though they'd be completely out of the picture mm-hmm. in the other two examples.
That's right. And therefore that we had to take account of the shielding column to prevent expulsion by radiation mm-hmm. pressure there.
But what happens with the shielding is that it just converts the flux to infrared. It doesn't eliminate the flux.
That's right.
So there's still plenty of flux moving through that system,
oh, yeah.
pushing on the cut.
No. So that pushing is taken into account here. We have enough column to prevent it from being exposed.
But what happens if that flux has to go out? It's going to push in the vertical direction.
Yeah, it will escape. I'm not saying it won't.
It will go out isotropically if the system is optically thick. It will go out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it's going to have a significant dynamical effect because it is moving out.
It will presumably squeeze the inner region, so you have to have enough column.
And as it travels through the material, push it up, away from the neutron, because that's probably the direction of easiest escape.
Yeah, but by the time it's reprocessing, it doesn't have to be. Locally super.
The reprocessing does not change the energy flux. It changes the opacity because it moves in a frequency space,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't change the energy flux. So it's still dynamically important.
The question is whether the source is optically thick in the re-radiated radiation, because if it is, flux in any given direction is going to be inversely proportional to the optical depth in that direction.
Yeah.
It's going to equalize the radiation.
Let me draw a picture of what I'm trying to say. If you have something that is optically thick in the reprocess frequency, then the flux lines will tend to kind of curve around, going out the direction of easiest escape, which will be in a semi-thin, in some kind of thin disk, more or less vertical. But that still means you have a lot of flux moving through an interesting part of this torus system, and the force in the vertical direction will be significant. So it's going to strongly influence questions like, is it locally self-gravitating? Can it clump? Etc.
So if we see a dusty wind, we might never know if it's driven by radiation pressure or by the mechanism you worked at.
Okay, well, that's an excellent introduction to the final topic of what I wanted to say, which is, this is kind of motivated for an alternative for 4258 to the pure clumped disk. But it really, I want to emphasize 1042, because as I mentioned, 4258, for all we know, could be a simple, the uniform warped model could be the best representation of it, period. But so I don't want to tie myself to 4258. But just as an illustrative model, to point out that you can have those mazes, you don't have to necessarily think of. You can change the way you think of this. So I talked about the wind coming out, this picture, and of course you can embed clouds which could be, like in the surface of the sun, you could have those reconnection events, diamagnetic bubbles, which in this picture would be just pushed out by the radiation pressure of the uniform wind. So imagine in this, so here we want to raise the clouds above the disk plane so that they can be illuminated, but instead of warping the disk, we just say let's let those clumps come up by the wind. And I'll lead you to quickly through a this is my last transparency, to a very kind of little toy model which gives surprising results, which are kind of interesting, or intriguing, at least to me. You can say, okay, let's assume that we have in fact such a wind, and that wind takes all the angular momentum from the disk. So that gives you immediately a relation to the angular momentum relation between the angular momentum that's carried in and the magnetic torque at the disk surface, and to some models like the Blanchflower and Payne self-similar model, you can relate it to the wind magnetic field with m dot, with some parameter delta which has typical numbers like 0.3. Okay, now we can say the clouds are coming up and they are confined by the field of the wind. That's the condition on their confinement. And so we equate the thermal pressure. We assume that they are diamagnetic and with relatively little field inside. So basically we equate the thermal structure, thermal pressure to the magnetic pressure in the wind. Then we again use the typical wind disk-driven wind models to relate the outflow rate in the wind to the disk, and typical numbers will be like 0.1 or thereabouts. Just this is again parameterized. And then one says, okay, I want to uplift clouds, as Roger mentioned before. If the clouds are very small, they would go up, but easily, but notice, of course, the tidal gravitational force is increasing as you move away from the disk, so if you get sufficiently massive clouds, at some point you won't be able to lift them anymore. So just by back of the envelope, you equate rim run pressure to tidal gravitational force, you get a fiducial mass like that. Then you can actually solve the equations and find out what would be a more typical coefficient here for clouds to be just about uplifted. Turns out it's about of order 8 or a few. So we can parameterize that in this fashion. So the clouds, the amazing clouds, would be then clouds that are sufficiently massive that are not going to be easily uplifted. And we actually look at their trajectories. Turns out that they kind of hover along the disk a little bit, move radially out, and then finally can overcome the, depending what the masses are, can overcome the tidal force and get out. But the main thing is that as long as they hover near the disk surface there, so this is just schematically, the light clouds would move up like that and would have a velocity law that would look like this, but the more massive clouds would kind of, that hover near the disk as a function of radius, they would have nearly Keplerian velocity laws because they basically would mimic the velocity law where they came from underneath. So, and finally, we just impose the condition that the Mazur efficiency is greater than 1. And using those fiducial values and characteristic temperatures like 500 degrees and applying this now to the parameters of 40 to 58, you find amazingly that this wind model gives you a characteristic radius which is not even, you don't even have to invoke this Mazur efficiency. You get a characteristic radius for the clouds which is 2 by 10 to 13 centimeters, quite amazingly, and when you put this efficiency parameter, you get typical cloud densities of 2 by 10 to the 9. So, interestingly, things just fall off in the right range for Mazurs, and in this picture, you don't have a warp, it's a selection effect. The cloud comes here and blocks the light, so the next cloud that you will see Mazing would be a little bit above it. And another interesting aspect of it is that here the shielding is from the typical parameters that you need to uplift the clouds and the number densities of the clouds. The shielding is still provided mostly by the wind. The clouds are needed to give the high densities, but the shielding is provided by the wind. So it's a combination of winds and clouds in this mental separation that gives you the amazing.
M times R to the clouds is about the same as
N. Yes, they're close. But they are, because there's a power loss scaling for the wind still wins.
So how do you distinguish this from the warp disk picture observation?
Well, the warp disk picture, for example, for example, the one that just this Hansen is much more systematic. I mean, so you could actually predict that you would see a ball and then you would get an obscuration. I mean, you could relate the corrections to the to the high velocity masers. To
so, for example, if you saw such
it's much more systematic.
Velocities and the high velocity.
So for the 40 to 58, they try to get a correction to the deviations from Keplerian motions, and then they applied it to this and got the right
radius.
There's
pretty strong limits on the problem of the systemic majors. I think they're extremely small.
Yeah.
So already doesn't that make it not support this? I mean, maybe not rule it out. But
say it again.
Well, I mean, I'm just trying. So you're saying that you'd see the you'd see some systematic, for example, outward motion.
This would be much too small to. Yeah, we actually hope that it could be
so
even space VLBI would not get you there.
And it seems to be only a couple of kilometers a second.
Okay. Yeah.
Something on this if you have a cloud that's moving up slowly, how do you keep the distribution of laser stops as it is? Why aren't there some that are up higher?
Well, as the clouds move up, they very rapidly decrease their densities because the field decreases very rapidly, and the field is what confines them. Yeah. It would be, yeah, as I was just telling Mitch, it would be very, yeah, even space VLBI, which I'm a proponent of, and it's not going to, yeah. So finally, to just summarize. Perfect. Okay, so we talked about the idea that Mesa disks are clumped. It's a model-independent result based on velocity coherent constraints in a Keplerian disk. And in a source like 1068, it gives some strong arguments why it's clumped. In 40 to 58, not so strong. The possibility that masers are clumped, that self-amplification, just the analog of the W49 flares, can explain the observation, just two clumps self-overlapping. And of course, then the variability, which is an issue because you see them all vary, can be explained. Also gives and strengthens the argument why there's an association with CIFAR-2-like galaxies. I was arguing that meso disks in source like 1068 can be in principle excited in a low mass circumnuclear disk, which is very close analog of our what we infer to be the circumnuclear ring in our own galactic center, with all the questions that brought about. And there was also the option of using clouds in a scenario with winds, where you just take the high end of the mass distribution in the clouds, and they could give rise in the shielded region to masers, also in a natural way. And of course, all those questions that I raised, which remain open, are those, on one hand, we can have those rings type things which are like clouds, disks of clouds, disks of clumps, and what are their properties? On the other hand, maybe this whole cloudy picture is incorrect, and we should just go back and think of turbulent medium and with the whole kind of hierarchical scale of density distributions, but nothing as discrete and well-defined as. So with this happy thought, I think we can go to lunch.
But you appeal to a hybrid magnetic wind, and that certainly is a tempting possibility, but could you also make it work with a radiation pressure driven wind, or does that not work?
Make work or the rising clouds. In principle, if you can raise them, yes. I've just recently become aware of work by Progat. I haven't really studied it, that uses local disk irradiation on lines and then just erase things and then possibly the central source radiation. Here it's a little bit, so I don't have a quantitative answer to that, because in the regime of the disk, the temperatures in the disk surface will be of the order of 1,000 degrees. So that may be too low. Is that right? 1,000 degrees, probably too low for... If one wanted to raise clouds just by line radiation pressure in the region of the mesas, the typical temperatures are like 1,000 degrees on the disk surface there. So that would be too low to really... Yeah.
Well, thanks very much.
Very good. By the way, we're in the habit of scanning all the references and putting them on the web.
Okay.
If that's okay with you, just...
Certainly, I should reorganize them.
Yeah, get them in order and then just give them to the ladies in the front office.
Okay, great. So, wonder, when can I start saying things off the record here? So.